Hi, this is Josh Levine, and Stefan Fatsis and I are going to bring you a special episode of Hang Up and Listen. We're recording this on June 4th, 2016, the day after Muhammad Ali's death. In 1964, a young New York Times sports writer named Robert Lipsight was assigned to cover, as he later put it, the dismemberment of the fighter, then known as Cassius Clay, at the hands of heavyweight champion Sonny Liston. After Clay shocked the world, Lipsight covered the boxer for the next 3 years as he changed his name to Muhammad Ali and helped redefine sports in American society. And Lipsight continued to write about Ali through his death on Friday. An agile mind, a buoyant personality, a brash self-confidence, and an evolving set of personal convictions fostered a magnetism that the ring alone could not contain, Lipsight writes in his obituary of Ali in the New York Times. He entertained as much with his mouth as with his fists, narrating his life with a patter of inventive doggerel. Robert Lipsight joins us now. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how are you guys? So I'm getting all these condolence calls, and I don't think we need to mourn. I think we just kind of need to celebrate what he once was, which really was the most interesting and spectacular sports figure that any of us have ever even thought about, I think. And most importantly, I think what we really want to do and what we want to do here on this podcast is remind people that he's not the secular saint in this kind of beatified teddy bear that people have been thinking of him in the last few years. He was a very controversial, very scary, very paradoxical, very interesting character who, in his time, kind of epitomized the splits in America. The thing that really makes me totally angry right now is stories coming out about Ali as this noted civil rights activist. If anything, early on, when he first rose to prominence, he was the anti-civil rights activist. We were kind of appalled. Most of us were kind of young liberal reporters who were really interested in this story. We're integrationists, and here he came out of the lost found nation of Islam, what we called the Black Muslims, who were making deals with the KKK and really wanted to segregate themselves from American society. End of rant.
So in the obituary, when you're given this task, and it was a huge one by the Times, you know, we're all kind of thinking about how do we take the full measure of a man who was such a towering figure in American history. How did you take on that task? And it seems like you're kind of still working through it today. How do you decide what to focus on and what maybe you just don't have room to include?
Well, you know, the advantage was when, you know, I had no expectations when I went down to Miami Beach. He was going to get beaten. And we knew he was going to get beaten because I was sent down. If they thought he had a chance, they would have sent a real reporter. So they send the kid down. I have no expectations. I'm not a boxing writer. I'm a feature writer. I'm you know, a couple of years older than he is. I'm thrilled to be there. And that kind of was the basis for the next, for the next 52 years of covering him. The idea that I was evolving, he was evolving, and the measure of the man is his evolution from this barely literate, clownish prodigy into, you know, something of a thoughtful, complex human being. And that was a kind of an interesting progression to watch it happen. I mean, in the very beginning when he gave speeches about the Black Muslims and his involvement with Allah and all. I mean, it was this terrible dogmatism of somebody who was not even able to totally integrate his new religion with his life. You know, later on, he could make jokes. So I think that catching the full measure of him is not trying to catch him at any particular point in time, but rather in the evolution of Cassius Clay into Muhammad Ali and the evolution of America, you know, in the 52 years of his time.
It really is striking, I think, that Ali's life can be compartmentalized in certain ways. And this is, of course, what you do 2020. But there were those early years when you stumbled into Florida and covered him through the brash rise to become heavyweight champion. And then there is the come down, his barring from boxing, his opposition to Vietnam, the change from this crazy fast talking young boxer into this symbol of something. And then the return when he's still a successful boxer, you know, winning the heavyweight title twice more. But by the same token, he's not the fast, unstoppable force in the ring that he was. And then he boxes too long till he was damn near 40, and very quickly soon after becomes ill, and the symptoms are clear, and he transitions into this sort of humanitarian, as you said, this cuddly, lovable humanitarian. It's a remarkable sort of arc of a life.
Absolutely. I think that you also answered the question better than I could have, because, you know, those are, of course, the chapters of that arc. And yet, I think back to the idea of not losing sight of a character is the fact that, you know, within all of that, within those changes, within those chapters, and most important, the change in perception, because society was now changing and in some ways coming around to some of his attitudes, was the fact that there was always that humor. That humor never left. You know, I think Dave Anderson wrote about the twinkle in his eye, and that was always true, because even towards the end, when he was virtually mute, you would come away with, you know, 10 minutes in his presence thinking you had just had this warm conversation where no real word was passed that could be understood. And yet there was this kind of, you know, sense of warmth, the twinkle in his eye, his own body language, maybe the way he reached and hugged you or touched you, that you really felt, you know, this constant human connection. And that was him always, even as a young man. So, I mean, those things were always there. There was a kind of humanity to him. The other thing was that beginning to end, his most important legacy was that he made us braver. In the beginning, as an amazing symbol, young black men to young white men who didn't want to go into the army, to people standing up for their principles against a government that was on a very wrong and illegitimate path. And then at the end, I always felt his kind of finest hour in making us braver was this symbol of the gallant patient. I mean, he never went and hid until he, you know, really was immobile. But he never went and hid. He was out there. He was brave. He showed us that he would, despite his infirmity, do as much as he could. And to me, I cried in 1996 when he lit the Olympic torch in Atlanta. You know, his whole body, his arm, his hand were shaking. And later somebody told me that some hot wax from the torch had flowed down and burnt his hand, and he, you know, refused to flinch. He didn't want to show anybody that something bad had happened. So, I mean, he was wonderfully symbolic. This is kind of a little crude, but in some ways, I always think of him as that door of the refrigerator in which we put magnets, you know, notes to ourselves, you know, little sayings, you know, they're kind of tiny bumper stickers. He was somebody that we could use for our wants and needs. He became the symbols that we wanted and needed, because he himself, other than, you know, standing firm and being tough and not quitting, he didn't really have, you know, strong and specific principles, attitudes, political stances. He was just a walking hug.
Before he became a symbol, he was a boxer. And I'd love to hear you describe what it was like to watch him fight, what the feeling was like in the arena.
Well, one of the reasons that the older reporters were antagonistic to him, besides the fact that he wasn't laconic like Joe Louis, their beau ideal, was the unorthodoxy of his style. And so what he did was very risky, and it was only possible because of his incredible speed and coordination. So there was always the sense that he was going to get tagged, that he was going to get hit really hard, because instead of, you know, moving from side to side and letting punches go over his shoulders harmlessly, he leaned back with the always the possibility that his opponent would take that one step forward and hit him again as he was leaning back and knock him into the ropes and then down to the canvas. And early on, the terrific speed, you know, that movement, that dance, it was exciting to watch. Also, I think that we, later on, when he had lost a lot of that speed, we underestimated, because he seemed like a quick and flashy boxer, we underestimated his ability and willingness to take punishment. He took a lot of punishment. He got hit hard. And one of the reasons that that worked, and eventually to his detriment, was that he allowed sparring partners to hit him in the gym. This is kind of rare among champions. When he was in the gym, he would let them hit him if they could. And it toughened him up. It also, as we know, began, you know, those endless insults to his brain that ended up in a kind of trauma that probably contributed to the Parkinson's. So he could take punishment, which was absolutely made clear in those three fights with Joe Frazier. And he could also dole out punishment. And even when he was not able to move as well as he could, he was still a slippery character. And there's a wonderful line by the LA Times' Jim Murray, who talked about his later boxing matches as recitals.
I think we sometimes forget that Ali was taken away from the sport in his absolute prime, 1967. I mean, he was, what, 25 years old, and he didn't box again until he was, what, Bob, 29?
Absolutely right. I mean, those were 3.5 of his prime years as a fighter. What would he have been like if he had kept progressing, you know, through those 3.5 years? But also, one would like to think that he would have quit earlier and not gone on and taken some really serious punishment, Ernie Shavers, Larry Holmes, towards the end.
There's a story you tell about interviewing Ali in a trailer. There are three women in there. Then two of them leave. Then the trailer starts shaking.
Well, yeah, I mean, his sexual exploits were beyond legend. The screenwriter, Ring Lardner, who wrote the screenplay for his book, The Greatest, as Ring explained, you know, since the book itself was totally unreliable, there was no reason that he had to write a reliable screenplay. So he made that up, too. But the point that he made, I couldn't understand how Ali could have so many sexual dalliances in the same day. And Ring Lardner explained that Ali did not allow himself to come to climax because he felt it was really important that he could at least give some sort of service to as many women as possible. To him, it was like giving autographs.
Why was this not in the obituary?
But the particular time that you're talking about was, yeah, he brought three women into this trailer, sent two out. A few minutes later, the trailer began to shake. And there were, you know, lots of people standing around the trailer because he had just fought an exhibition match in a field in Florida. And I remember, you know, his handlers and Angelo Dundee, his trainer, and you know, everybody saw me standing there, you know, writing notes in my notebook, and they said, you know, this is off the record. It didn't happen. I said, well, it's happening in front of hundreds of people. How can it not happen? He said, no, but if you write it, If you write it in the New York Times, if you can get it into the New York Times, you will lose access and you will never be able to talk to Muhammad Ali again. And I kind of thought about it, and I felt really sad about it, because this was in the 70s. But you know, what can you do? It's not as if I was the only one in the world who saw it and I could be discreet. You know, it was a public event, so I wrote it. And it was the end of a magazine piece in the New York Times Magazine, and I just kind of described the scene. I think I may even have kind of flounced it up by saying that the trailer had shaken like Emma Bovary in her carriage with her lover going around the park. But the title, which I did not write, was King of All Kings on the magazine piece. So now it's, you know, like 6 months later, and I understand that Ali's not going to talk to me, but I'm sent down to do a piece on Ali on set for The Greatest. And I know, you know, on a movie set, there are lots of people who'll talk to me, you know, even if the hero doesn't, no problem. So I go on the set, and the first thing I hear is this yell, "Bob," and it's Ali running over to me. He gives me a big hug, and he smiles, and he said, "King of all kings, boy, you got that right." So, I mean, so much for protecting, you know, Ali's sexual dalliances. And, of course, all of this was done while he was married to other people who were not in attendance at the time.
Bob, how do you think that Ali came to be this representation of so many different things in American culture, race, class, religion, goodness, badness, braggadocio, the rise of what you called sports world? And how did he come out as this benighted, beloved figure?
Think of the moment of creation. One, here is the most beautiful creature I have ever seen. The Beatles also thought so, and so do millions of other people. So here's this absolutely gorgeous human being. He's warm. He's funny. He's totally lovable. And then he delivers his boast. Wow. We go for that in America. And what is his boast? That he is the toughest man on the planet. 1964, remember, the heavyweight championship really still mattered in America, in the world. So here's the heavyweight championship going to the most beautiful man on the planet, this lovable braggart, who now we know is not a braggart because he's telling the truth. And then suddenly he becomes involved in the most important issues in American life. Number one, the most important, race. Number two, the time of this terrible turbulence over America in this war that's splitting us apart. And three, he steps out of the primary religion in America. He's an apostate. He becomes a Muslim. We don't even know what a Muslim was, most of us at that time. So from that beginning, and it's not as if he, you know, then got beaten or disappeared or you know, changed his mind about anything. You know, from that very beginning, that amazing explosive beginning, he just kind of grew and grew and grew. And people loved him and hated him and misunderstood him willfully. And so there was, as long as he could keep going, as long as he could keep that flame alive, and, you know, thanks to Howard Cosell, he even kept that flame alive during that 3.5 years where he was not boxing. And then he comes out on the other end. He returns to us, and we really appreciate him because, one, he's made the sacrifice that we really understand in America. You know, he gave up millions and millions of dollars for his principal. And two, he went through this blood redemption where, you know, he really got punished and beaten hard to prove himself as a man, you know, against his toughest opponent, Joe Frazier. So, you know, by that time, I think he's totally locked into our minds. And a whole generation of young, white, American boys and the girls and mothers who loved them really loved him because he took away the stigma, the onus of not wanting to serve your country, of being, quote, a draft dodger, because this man, this incredible, principled, beautiful man, who could have had an easy job in the Army, who gave up millions of dollars, who stood firm, you know, kind of hung manhood on everybody else. I mean, it was amazing into the 80s and 90s, sitting with him in restaurants and having men of his age now, late middle age, kind of come up to him with tears in their eyes and thanking him. They're not thanking him for being heavyweight champion. They're thanking him for making them feel principled and like men too. So with all these things going on, and of course the attitude of the country has now changed towards the Vietnam War, he has moved to a more orthodox form of Islam. He's certainly not a segregationist anymore. He's obviously a hero, and he's easier to take now. He's not dogmatic. And as he becomes more and more infirm, he becomes less and less threatening. And that past, in which he really did antagonize so many people and really did frighten the government, they thought that African Americans would refuse to serve in the Army now. All that recedes in the past, and all is left is this man who is famous for being famous. And it's, I go into high schools for, my young adult novels, and it's kind of heartbreaking. I have to, kind of explain who Muhammad Ali is. And he's not just, isn't he? He's that kind of old sick boxer. No, he's not an old sick boxer. He's, symbolic of the last 50 years of American life.
A lot of people didn't like Muhammad Ali, though. I mean, the government certainly was looking at Ali in the 60s. He was a counterculture figure. He didn't embody, for many people, progress in America. He was a threat to America.
Yeah, they were afraid of him basically because as it was getting harder and harder to get troops to Vietnam, there was always the feeling that, what happened, once, minority boys refused to serve. I mean, they did not, which really meant the government didn't really understand American people if they thought that this guy was going to keep people out of the Army, which, of course, he never did. And also the early involvement with Malcolm X, which, scared them. And then there were a lot of, quote, patriotic people who were, how can you refuse to fight for your country and you're willing to go and beat up other boys? I'd been in the Army by that time, and I wasn't totally immune from that feeling myself. I was against the war, for sure, and I was for the protests and everything like that, but there was something ambivalent in my attitude. I hadn't really quite worked it out yet about his conscientious objection, and a lot of people were very angry about that. So, I mean, if I had my qualms, and I was invested in him, you can imagine a lot of other people were. Yeah, he was very controversial. I think a lot of that, passed away as people's attitudes towards the war changed.
Was there a single moment, a quiet one or a loud one, where you were in Ali's presence and felt like, okay, I'm getting the real guy now. Like, this is the real Ali.
Yeah, there were a lot of moments like that. I remember one of them, we were rushing to a plane in an airport, and I really wanted to make the flight and get home. And as we're rushing, a small older woman stood in front of us with one of those throwaway cameras. And he stopped and he posed. She took the picture. I grabbed his arm and said, come on, let's go. Wait, he said. She had the lens cap on. He reached over and very delicately took out the lens cap and posed again, took the picture. Then I grabbed him, and he said, she would have felt bad the rest of her life that she didn't get that picture. I said, yeah, but we're going to miss the plane. And he said, we're not going to miss the plane. They're going to wait for me. And they did. And then we got to the plane, and he said, sit by me, Bob. And I said, well, I can't, I have an economy class ticket. You have a first class ticket. He said, sit by me. I'm the champ. They'll let you sit there. And they did. And I mean, in some strange sort of ways, I keep thinking about that. You know, this this enormous kindness, this incredible narcissism, and also this sense of who he was and what other people thought of him. It's a very small moment, but I mean, it meant a lot to me.
Robert Lipsight wrote the obituary for Muhammad Ali for the New York Times. He's the author of the memoir, The Accidental Sports Writer, and many other books. Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be back with a full episode of Hang Up on Monday. And we'd love your feedback on what we talked about on today's mini episode on Muhammad Ali. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes. You can find it at itunes.com/slatepodcast, and you can leave us a comment and a rating there too. Our intern is Laura Wagner. Producing this episode is Dan Bloom. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Steve Lickteig, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.